So I'd like to start this talk out with a quote from the Buddha that's found in Numerical Discourses. He says, wise lay people improve two kinds of skills. First, they develop the ability to obtain new wealth and to secure the acquired wealth. Next, they learn how to differentiate between wholesome and unwholesome conduct and how to follow a wholesome way of life. Lay followers of my teaching secure a tenfold improvement in their external progress, and they develop skill to obtain more property, increase wealth, improve family relationships, establish a strong force, and obtain more four-footed animals such as horses and sheep. In their inner growth, my lay followers develop confidence in their spiritual path, discipline themselves, acquire more knowledge, practice generosity, and gain wisdom. I'm really glad that we are talking about wealth, because I'm glad that's the way we're going to start this out this whole year. Because I think of all the places where people have had struggles in practice, wealth is one of the biggest issues around. I mean, I started talking about this on Thursday night with the Capitol Hill Sangha and Sunday, and there's a lot of tension, a lot of difficulty with this idea of talking about wealth. It seems like it should just be simple, but it's not. And I want to talk a little bit tonight about why I think it's so difficult to practice and talk about wealth and talk about wealth in relation to practice. And I thought the way I would do this, since we did the Refuges and Precepts last week, that I would talk about acquiring wealth tonight, and then next week I'll talk about maintaining it, and then the third week we'll have a discussion about those two. So we're only going to have one discussion this month, and I decided to do it at the end so we could have a discussion about the month's practice. And I want to take the framework from a bhikkhu, what's his name? Vasanaguda Rahula. He's a Sri Lankan monk who teaches, I think he teaches English in Texas, University of Houston. And he has a PhD and, you know, he writes about wealth, prosperity from the Buddhist point of view, is his views on it. And I just want to take that framework to give us something to talk about. Because he points a lot to the suttas and points a lot to things that Buddha said that we may not have made connections. And I've already had some changes in my understanding, which is always a good thing. Troubling, but a good thing. Troubling for a teacher, because I got to go back and think about everything I said before and then check and see, oh, what was that? That's the only problem with recording talks, you know. I give talks on retreat. This is a little aside. And people will say to me, I can't find your talks on Dhamma Seed. You know, I look, I can't find them. I'm like, that's because I don't publish them. I only leave them for the people who paid for the retreat, right? You paid for a retreat. That's who gets the talk. And And also it's because the talks are in the context of that retreat for the people that are sitting there. And then, you know, it's hard to just listen to a random talk, even though I do listen to random talks on Dharma Seed. So anyway, there's some things that I have come to understand that I've made some changes in the way I look at things. And I'll talk about that in just a minute. But the reason why I think topics, any topic in Dharma brings up difficulties, brings up tension, is because oftentimes when you're talking in the about Dharma and you're practicing with Dharma, you are rubbing up against your views. You're rubbing up against the view that you see the world through in relation to that topic. So whatever that, you know, you can call it right view, wrong view, whatever that view is, that's what you're rubbing up against. And that rub is the place where we practice. So wealth, one other thing that about that rub, we're going to get into, but that rub is usually associated with something we learned in our childhood. And we're still holding on to it years later. And that's what we come face to face with practice. And so some of what practice is doing is bringing the unconscious, the things that we, the habit, the things that we kind of, the assumptions we hold, the views we have from the way we were raised and things we saw when we were younger, set in motion in our minds. The Dharma has a way of bringing the unconscious conscious, bringing the habit forward, bringing the patterns in our lives into view so that we can see them. And one of the things that's associated, that the Buddha kind of associated with wealth, was happiness. And he connected it in the Samyutta Nikaya. He was talking about identifying happiness and said that there are two kinds of happiness. One kind is associated with monastic life, renunciate life, and one kind of happiness is associated with lay life. So right there, it's understanding that we don't live a happy life as a lay person trying to live our lives like a monastic. And likewise, a monastic cannot live a happy life trying to live their life like a lay person. We are living two different practices, two different worlds, two different lives, but there is happiness in both lives. And we, as lay practitioners, we have to actually enjoy life as lay practitioners. I think the reason why this is, I thought about this, I brought this up on Thursday, that I think the reason why we have this conflict as lay practitioners, and it feels like this huge conflict around what to do about wealth. Lots of people come to practice talking about this idea of pursuing certain jobs, and my job is in conflict with my practice. I want to make a lot of money, but then, you know, maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I should be more altruistic and more loving and generous and leave all that money behind. There's just this conflict around how to be with abundance and money and stuff in a world of practice that seems to point to not having stuff and simplicity and no, it's not, it's scarcity and less than, and it just seems different. And I think it has to do with how we come in contact with the fifth. You know, Buddha was a monk, so for thousands of years, his practice, his teachings were carried and held and protected by monastics. He had all these followers and they were all monastics. it's not that the community didn't practice with the Dhamma, but in Asia, I never went to Asia, so I don't want to speak too much into it like I know what I'm talking about. But just of the conversation I've had with people, I'm not even going to say that. Anyway, so people have talked about there's this kind of way in which monastics were the meditators and the community were lay practitioners. There was a distinction. There's monastics, they live in whatever, you know, they're wandering monks or they live in a monastery. And then there's the lay community that takes care of the monastics, and the monastics take care of the spiritual needs of the lay community. It was very simple, very, you know, a very hard line, and you could see the difference pretty easily, however each side lived. And when Joseph and Jack and Sharon went to India, they brought this practice back here to the States, or to the West in general, they created a little bit of a problem, because what they created was not monasteries for monastics to go in. They created retreat centers for lay practitioners to go practice in. So now, instead of having monastic monks, nuns, and monasteries, we have teachers and retreat centers, Dhamma halls, Dhamma centers, urban practicing places. And it creates kind of a difficulty, because when we go to retreat, we don't take on the life of a monastic, but we go into a renunciate type existence for the duration of that retreat. And then we leave that retreat and we come home. So we go to that retreat and we have this beautiful experience. It's so wonderful, in touch with myself, and I feel like I can love the whole world. And by the time I leave, there's like a glow. It's like beautiful. We think, oh, this is the way I'm supposed to live in order for me to have this glow, this sense of loving even the ants. You know, here's another aside. So sometimes our retreats, in long retreats, when you really, really get deep in concentration, you'll see people taking little sticks, and they will be lifting up the worms to get them off the path, to put the worms or the little bug to the side where nobody's going to walk and smash them in their walking. So beautiful. But I've always had this thought, what if they spent the whole morning getting to that side of the path, and you just put them back on the wrong side? You know, what if they were working their way towards something and you put them on the wrong side? How do you know which direction they were going? That's just a whole other side. But I'm just saying, that's how we get when we go to retreats. We get very deep, deeply connected to this sense of universal love. I'd say the Brahma Viharas. A sense of abundance, a sense of care, love, all of it. And then we come home to lay practice. And you can, anybody that's ever gone on a retreat, it's pretty clear that it feels very disjointed when we come home. It feels like I'm in another world, like something's wrong. Everything I'm doing is wrong. We gotta stop all of this, because there's abundance and there's wanting and there's desire. All of that. And I think the Buddha was fully aware of this, and he made a distinction that we don't always make. And that's one of the reasons why I'm glad Tim and I decided to talk about the Dhamma in everyday life, because you're going to see this distinction he made. He said that monastic life, the happiness that monastics get, is derived from the giving up of sensory satisfaction. So reason why we go on retreat, the reason why we have so much happiness on retreat is because it's structured to help us give up sensory desire. It's designed to help us chip away at our sensory kind of wanting. And what we begin to experience is the freedom from a wanting mind. And we begin to feel more satisfied with whatever is. But that's because somebody else is cooking for us. Somebody else built those buildings. We don't have to pay the rent on them places. I mean, we pay our fees. But from my understanding, the fees never really for what it costs to run a retreat center. So we're living somewhere. We don't have to maintain that place. Somebody else cooks. In fact, the yogis, we cook for each other and we clean for each other. So we don't even have to clean for ourselves. We are living in a world that is conditioned and created for the purpose of learning what it's like to let go of wanting. But as soon as we get home, we are not in the world of non-wanting. We are in the world of wanting. And that is because the happiness that is derived in life for a lay person is derived through sensory satisfaction. That's where happiness comes from. Now that was kind of a game changer for me. He put it in the Sutta Pitaka. He said that it's derived, our happiness is derived from sensory satisfaction. In fact, he said the satisfaction gained, this is what Buddha said. Well, this is the English translation of what Buddha said. Satisfaction gained through the five senses or experiences through the five senses means, let's see. Oh, our satisfaction is gained through the five senses. And experiences that we have through the five senses means a 5-4 advantage one can obtain in lay life. And that advantage is happiness. So what he's basically pointing to is our relationships with our senses is where happiness lies as a lay person. This is where I came to my rethinking. Because this might seem like this is contradictory from where we were all last year talking about dependent co-arising. And all that we were talking about was let go of clinging. The sense doors are the problem. Get out of that desiring. That's the problem. And so there's a part of us that might have a sense that we're going the opposite direction. But actually, I don't think that's what we're going to do. I'm hoping I can talk about this in a way that you'll see that we're not going in an opposite direction. We actually needed the dependent origination work we did to enable us to really practice this year with Dhamma in everyday life. So my big change is with Bahia. You guys that know me, you know I love Bahia. I love him. He, for those of you that don't know him, he was a, I don't know the backstory so much, but he's a regular person and he was part of a shipwreck. Somebody told me and I can't remember now, but anyway, he wandered around and these, villagers thought that he must be a holy man. So they began to make him robes and bring him food and he began to take on this practice. He was not an ordained monk. He was just a regular person. This becomes significant when you think about what Buddha, the instructions that Buddha gave him, which I never connected until I started reading up on wealth. But Bahia's problem was because people were giving him all this help, he basically thought he was on his way to enlightenment any minute now. So the kind people were showing him, and his made up practice was what he thought was going to lead him to enlightenment. And a spirit being talked to Bahia and basically told him, "You're going the wrong way, bruh. You're going to have to go and talk to the Buddha in order to get straight. Because if you keep going down the direction you're going away from enlightenment. You're not even close to it." And I think that is what I always liked about Bahia, because there's a level of confidence he had that he knew what he was doing and he was going his way. And I feel that way about me sometimes. I can get in that, "Oh, I know what I'm doing, so I'm going. This way I'm going to go. And I know I'm close to it." So luckily, he goes and he talks to Buddha. And the Buddha, these are the instructions the Buddha gave him. Because Bahia wanted the Buddha to give him a quick and dirty, easy way to get enlightened, just in case he could get dead. So he was in the mood to practice, and just in case I die quick, give me the quick and dirty. Don't give me the long, drawn-out discourses, just the quick and dirty. And the Buddha, after, you know, a few times, he finally said, "Okay, Bahia, okay, okay, okay. This is what you need. Pay attention to your sense doors." So when you're in the sense doors, so when you're seeing, just see. When you're hearing, just hear. When you're tasting, just taste. Just do the sense doors. And when you let go of anything other than that door, then you're going to let go of yourself. When you let go of yourself, then you're going to let go of Bahia. And if you let go of Bahia, you're going to go towards enlightenment. So basically what he was telling Bahia, the new thing to me is I never made the connection that Bahia was a lay practitioner. But he was. I always thought of this just from the framework of monastics, because Buddha was a monastic and he was always talking to monastics, but he did not talk the same way with lay people. And so what he was pointing Bahia to is, in Bahia's world as a lay practitioner, he is surrounded by sensory experience. And how we begin to practice with these sensory experiences says a lot for our pointing out towards awakening. And just so you know, Bahia did get awakened. He died shortly thereafter because he got ran over by a cart with a horse. But he got awakened before he died. So it was a good thing the Buddha talked to him. So what that tells me is, this year, we are actually practicing with our sensory experiences. And that these sensory experiences are going to help us learn how this practice comes alive in our everyday life. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about it when it comes to, let's talk a little bit about it with wealth. I can talk about this from this point of wealth and technology. Tim may not approach these everyday things in the same way, but this is the way I'm going to kind of approach it. This, how do we experience these things on a sensory level? So if I start with wealth, I want to share this quote that I said about gaining wealth. He said, "I found two important principles." This is in acquiring wealth: not to be content with what I had achieved and not to give up the effort for the highest achievement. Right effort is the step towards success. Right effort brings benefits and happiness to a layperson. So this monk, Bhikkhu Rahula, he says there's three ways to look at this. These are three ways I want to talk about tonight, and then we'll talk about maintaining this next week. But first, pay attention to these self-imposed limitations, is what he called. Self-imposed limitations. What I think of when I think of self-imposed limitations, I think this is about how we approach money, how we approach the wanting mind. So part of the difficulty we have when we come home from a retreat is the sensory experience that's happening with us that seems so vastly different than the experience we had when we were on retreat, when our senses were basically guarded. And it can give us the impression that having all of this wanting and desire as being a problem, but it's not really a problem. It's more that we need to see through the connection with our senses, the wrong view around the experience of wanting money, what we have, what we don't have. A good example of this would be when you go to, for those of you that are non-vegetarian, you'd appreciate this. You go to a retreat, it's vegetarian food. And everyone I know that's a non-vegetarian, as soon as that retreat's over, guess what we want to go get? Meat. Hot dogs, hamburgers. We're driving out of the retreat center on our way to the first restaurant that's got a really good burger, and that's where we're stopping. We're going there first, and then we're making our way home. Even if we fly all the go all the way to the airport, we're going to the first restaurant that has some meat there, and then we're going to wait for our plane to go home. We leave early, get to the airport early so we have time to eat. This is a sensory experience. That's what that is. That longing for our own bed, that getting our coffee and doing these things that we live by. These are all sensory experiences, and they are connected to our level of happiness. But I was describing to someone that we impose these kind of limitations on ourselves about whether or not it's okay to experience this kind of wanting. And we impose it mostly in areas of acquiring money, wealth. People will ask me, well, can I work in this kind of a job? What about goals? I want to raise this. I want to have goals to make a lot of money, or I want to do this, or I want to do that. Can I do that? Is that okay? Is it limited in that? And I'm like, no, why would you think that? You're a lay practitioner. You got to pay rent somewhere. You're going to have to pay a mortgage or a rent somewhere. If you don't have any money, I mean, you're pretty late on where you're going to pay your rent at. If you don't want to live in that apartment, then you're going to have to make more money. Then you're going to have to do something that's going to change your level of wealth, or you're going to be living in the apartments you don't want to live in. This is the reality that Buddha knew lay people had to live with. I don't think we're the first people that ever had to pay rent, pay to live somewhere. And so acquiring wealth is something that's inherent that we have to do. And part of that acquiring wealth is what determines what kind of sensory experience we're going to have. So when we start coming up against, rubbing up against our wants, then we're really coming up against some of the self-imposed limitations that we impose in our lives about what we can and cannot have. So when we can begin to see wealth as a part of life and acquiring wealth as a part of life, and how much wealth we have is connected to how we're going to live our lives, we can begin to see a little bit more about the importance of acquiring wealth that the Buddha was pointing to. In fact, I'm certain he realized that a lot of people that the Buddha talked to, Brahmins, were people serious money. So a lot of what he had to deal with, he dealt with a lot of people who didn't have nothing, and he dealt with a lot of people that had a lot, way more than they needed. And so but when you read the way he talks, there's never any kind of judgment on people or a sense of disrespect towards people. In fact, one of my favorite suttas was a regular layperson going to the Buddha saying, hey, you know, the way you monks live is fine, but, you know, we're lay people. We like laying in the bed with lots of children and eating good food. You know, what about us? Can we have some kind of freedom? I love it. I mean, because the Buddha's answer wasn't like, oh, you shouldn't be laying in the bed, having all that sex, eating all that good food. He wasn't talking about that. He was like, oh, yeah, well, you know, this is what will be a benefit to a lay provider, lay person. And he was just sharing more about, you know, being around good friends, keeping the precepts, you know, acquiring wealth. That's what, this is what's going to help us as providers, as lay practitioners. So the second part of this is to begin to check our self-imposed limitations around wealth, around how I should live. What are you trying to live your life like a retreat center, and you are miserable trying to do it at home? You know, like when we're home, we don't want anyone to talk to us simply because we're still living in a retreat center. But in a retreat center, nobody's talking to nobody. But when you come home, you know, your family might be like, I'm not living in that noble silence. I'm talking. I got the TV going, the radio going, everything else going. I'm not living in that. And then if you start getting irritated, can you not see that that is a self-imposed limitation? So when it comes to our wanting and buying, there are lots of self-imposed limitations. And then the other side of that, we're going to talk about in just a second, but we also have to have faith in our own potential. It means Dhamma brings confidence and reliance, self-reliance. And so all of this, that in order to understand wealth in your practice for you, does not come from listening to a Dhamma talk from me. It comes from you beginning to practice with the edges that you have around wealth. And that practice is going to tell you one way or the other where we fall. So an example would be, we live in a country where there is abject poverty and there is immense wealth. So do we just kind of ride in the middle and pretend like we don't see all that? Is that how we do it? So kind of like cocooning ourselves in our own little practice world, and I'm just living my little world. I got my little monies. I don't have immense wealth, and I don't have abject poverty. So I'm kind of good in the middle, riding along without any concern about it either way. It's not that we need to decide. We need to hate the people that have wealth, and we don't need to pity the people that don't have any money. But can you even be around people who don't have any money and people who have immense money and not make these judgments? That's what I saw with the Buddha. When you read his suttas, he could be with Brahmins and he could be with complete untouchables, and he never seemed to express himself differently. Didn't have that kind of judgment around wealth and who had it and who didn't have it, because he knew where happiness lies, and it lies in your sensory experience. So what Bhikkhu Rahula was saying was, after you kind of begin to work on these self-imposed limitations around wealth, and you start working on your own faith in your potential to acquire wealth, to be around wealth, to be in conflict with it, that you can then begin to point this towards right effort. And right effort, just so you remember, is abandoning the unskillful that has any unskillfulness that's showing up in your behavior, you abandon that, and you prevent any unskillfulness from arising in the future. That's the second one. So abandoning is the first, prevent the arising in the second. Third one is cultivating skillful behaviors, thoughts, actions, and sustaining any skillful behavior, thoughts, actions that you see present. So that's pretty much what right effort is. So in order for us to begin, and right effort, you can think of it as practicing. In order to practice with this, we got to begin to pay attention to where our limitations are and to have some faith in our ability and, I think, desire to practice with it. All of that is what I think of as what I would call inner work. This is the inner work that we're doing. Right effort with our inner work and right effort with our outer work is what we're going to talk about next week. But this week is about right effort with our inner work. So I want to see if I can give you a couple examples. So if you think about a monastic who pleasure arises out of sensory deprivation or denying the sensories, the sense doors, or abandoning is what I wrote here, sensory desire. And we live in a world where our happiness is derived from sensory desire. Then a practice would be, for a monastic, it would be abandoning the sense doors, the wanting, wanting, wanting. We're going to have wanting because we're living in a sensory world. So our practice is on, am I getting gluttonous or am I selfish, stingy, right? Am I like overly addicted to getting what I want, want, want? Or am I denying all the want, 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 and I'm miserable? This is where the line is around wealth. There's a way of abundance can be gluttonous, where I just keep wanting more and I keep getting in more and more and more and more and more. And then there's this kind of a selfishness. I was telling people on Sunday that I grew up with a father who was very strict on money, very stingy, what I would call stingy around money. And I grew up with a mother who didn't know that money had any limits. She, as soon as she go to a store and she'd say, can I get that on credit? And they'll say, yeah, can get that on credit. She's like, great. And she would just get everything on credit. And my father and her would have these huge arguments about her spending all the money and he doesn't spend any money, but he would also relish in all the things that she bought. And so it was always this crazy world I grew up in. But I grew up from an understanding that we were poor because we were always desperate for money. And my sister grew up thinking we grew up middle class. So she has this middle class mentality. I have this impoverished mentality. We go and live our lives. So whenever I get any money, I spend it all. I was telling people I lived on welfare for so many years and they pay you once a month. So by the fifth, they pay you on the first. By the fifth, I don't have any more money. So I'm living in poverty until the end of the month of that first or the next month. My sister, she could save, you know, like $1 million making $150 a week. That woman could save anything. And she lived on very, very little money, but she had all this money in the bank. The two of us, I'm hoping you can see, both of us lived in poverty. I was gluttonous. She was selfish, kind of a I think she thought of herself as frugal, but she was very stingy. And yet we both lived in this very conflicted way that my parents lived. We lived exactly the same way, even though the reasons behind that was different. It had to do with our views. So in this area of practicing with wealth, And acquiring wealth, you got to begin to look at how you are in your relationship with money. Is it gluttonous, spending, spending, spending? Is it selfish? Another way you could think about it is, do you have a sense of abundance? So this would be the gluttonous selfish would be the abandoning and preventing the arising of unskillful behavior. And then the cultivating and sustaining skillful behavior is, what's your sense of abundance and generosity versus, are you like overly, are you in moderation or are you overly giving everything away? So you're looking at generosity and your level of moderation in relationship to it. Are you paying attention to how much you have and how much you put out? That kind of relationship with money, these are inner practices, but my always being poor, I needed to begin to pay attention to how I was spending money. And my needing, my sister's needing fear that she wasn't going to have any money from growing up in the way we did, she like overly held on to money and would not share it with anybody. I think this is where you practice with when you're talking about practicing with wealth, is on this line here. I gotta look here because there's a couple more things I wanted to talk about, but I don't think I'm going to get to them. I can see that now. So Venerable Panawati one time, she told me if she had her way about a retreat center, what she would do is she would find out on a questionnaire before you came whether you were an averse person, a greedy person, or a deluded person. And she'd say the averse person, she would put them in a room that was just like way too expensive for them. Like the minute they'd walk in that room, they'd be like, oh, this is too much. This is too much. This is too nice. I can't be in here. She'd make them stand there. And for the greedy person, she put them in a room where they got like a bed, a lamp, and maybe a rug. Maybe you got a pillow in there, maybe not. Very sparse. And for the deluded person, she put them in a room, I think she said, where there was a lot of rules on the, that they would have to follow all these rules about how they would be in this room in order to be in this room and all this, rigidness, all this decisiveness that you have to decide. Because she said that when you go on retreat and you're in practice, you are practicing up against your edges. And so you want to practice up against your edges. So I think this year, that's what we want to do. Think of this as we're going on retreat. And we're going on retreat in lay life. I mean, this is so perfect because we're stuck at home anyway. It's not like, I mean, we can't even get into the retreat centers. And even when we retreat, we are retreating here in lay life. So this is this going into retreat, and we want to go up against the edges of our lives. It's not just ignoring whatever you have to do about money. I think this whole practice this month is about actually looking at your relationship with more than just money. With wealth, you want to look at your relationship with your family and how the family spends money and how you are in relationship with that money. Sort of like the difference between me and my sister. You want to look at how you are with your wanting. You know, sometimes living in an apartment building, I've decided the worst thing that it's either brilliant or it's horrible of Amazon Prime. Because things don't, you don't pay for the shipping. And if you live in an apartment building, you can see all these packages that other people have, and it triggers in you, oh, I gotta go buy something. And you get into the house and you're buying something on Amazon Prime. It won't cost you anything. Clearly you need that. And I watch the way my mail area gets swamped with packages, and then there's no packages. And then there's a whole bunch of packages and there's no packages. I think every time people see all those packages, they go in and buy packages. And then there's the delay in the getting those packages back to us. You want to look at that. You want to look at the buying and the spending. These are edges that tell us how we are in our views around money and abundance. But that's the other thing, abundance. Do you think we're in a world of scarcity right now? Do you think we're in a world of abundance? Do you think we're coming into, is the future like bright or is it dark? What is it in relationship to what we're going to do? All of this might not seem like it has to do with wealth, but it does. Because it has to do with your sense of the sensory experience of happiness. I think I told you guys this one time, but I went to a retreat and I had the most beautiful sensory experience. I thought I was having some enlightened moment. This is my last story. I thought I was having some kind of enlightenment moment. I'm sitting in the dining hall and having this blissful moment. And I'm sitting there thinking, what is it about this moment? So beautiful. Why, what's happening? You know, and I started noticing all this hearing going on. It was just hearing, hearing, hearing. So I'm paying attention to the sounds of the dining hall and the kitchen and the spoons and people rustling about and clinging with the dishes. And I got this vivid memory of when I was a young girl. Denny's used to let us go and sit in Denny's. And as long as we bought coffee, we didn't have to pay. We didn't have any money. We were all in high school. We didn't have money. But we could put together enough money to buy a pot of coffee. And they usually gave us like they'll refill the pot three times, then you got to buy another pot. So we get this pot of coffee. And I would sit there with my friends and talk about stuff. In this great happiness around being at Denny's, just sitting there drinking coffee. No money, no nothing. But when I would be in that dining hall at a retreat center, that's what I heard. That sensory experience would set in motion for my sense of having this wonderful, blissful moment. This is what we're trying to pay attention to. Dependent origination hopefully got us to see how important our sense doors are. And now we need to begin to see how these sense doors are controlling our everyday existence, how they are pushing us into believing whether something is good or bad or indifferent. So I thought I'd leave us with this poem. It's not really a poem. It's a quote that's attributed to this Hopi indigenous elder from Arizona. This is what he says. I think it's a he, not sure. So let's just call him a they. They said, you've been telling the people that this is the 11th hour. Now, you must go back and tell the people that this is the hour and there are things to be considered. Where are you living? What are you doing? What are your relationships? Are you in right relation? Where's your water? Know your garden. It's time to speak your truth, create your community, be good to each other, and do not look outside yourself for the leader. Then he clasped his hands together, smiled, and said, "To my fellow swimmers, there is a river flowing very fast. It is so great and swift that there are those who will be afraid. They will try to hold on to the shore. They will feel they are being torn apart and will suffer greatly. Know the river has its destination. The elders say we must let go of the shore, push into the middle of the river, keep our eyes open and our heads above the water. And I say, see who is in there with you and celebrate. For in this time in history, we are to take nothing personally, least of all ourselves. For the moment we do, our spiritual growth and journey comes to a halt. The time of the lone wolf is over. Gather yourselves. Banish the word struggle from your attitude and your vocabulary. And all that we do now must be done in a sacred manner and in celebration. For we are the ones we have been waiting for." So let's sit a moment. Thank you so much for your kind attention. It's a little long. I didn't expect it to be quite so long, but sometimes when I get to talking Dhamma, I get a little nerdy and I don't know how to stop. But let's see if there's maybe a couple of questions. I see a hand. Katie.
Hey, Tweri. First of all, I just love this topic, and I'm so glad we're talking about all these things this year. I'm very excited about it, so thank you. Mm-hmm. So I really relate to your sister. I also grew up pretty poor with a single mom, and even though I'm successful now and I've had promotions and all of that, it's hard for me to kind of shake that mentality. And this year, I've been really trying to not be in this place of fear around money. And I've kind of like built things into my budgeting app where I give to charity and I do these other things. But I've noticed that anytime I'm like spending money or trying to do things for other people, it's kind of like intellectually, I'm like getting myself to do that, to spend the money, to like kind of try to get over that, but it still kind of gets stuck in my heart area. There's like a lot of fear. And yes, I really want to get to this place, or I'd like to get to this place where I can like feel more open in my heart space around that, where it feels more genuine and just overall feels better. So I just didn't know if you had any advice about how I could blend that with some kind of heart practice, or just how to open up more and not just have it be all like this thing up in my head, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It does. One, I think Buddha was known for telling people to relish in your good works. So we don't relish in our good works. It's kind of weird. We do the opposite in the West. But the Buddha always started with great generosity. He got people's minds brightened and talked. When he was talking to lay people, he didn't talk from austerity. He talked from happiness, joy, upbeat energy. And then once people's hearts were open, then he would talk about, renunciation and attachment and craving and suffering and stuff like that. We do the opposite. We start with the suffering, and then try to open the heart. So one way to counter that kind of thing, I think, is to begin to appreciate when you do good work and beginning to understand it's not how much you do, it's the recognition of good works. Does that make sense? This kind of not, it's the recognition that you put it in your budget, not how much am I putting in the budget? Do I have, is that there? It's the learning to feel into the idea of budgeting for charity and that is good work. Do you see that? So what you're actually doing is in this beginning to see the self-limiting thoughts is connected to not what do I need to do so I don't feel bad, but to feel in the feel bad to see where the line is. This is something a teacher taught me about Donna that I think I have always lived with. So for example, it's part of why I left and came as a teacher to live in generosity. That was a huge problem for me because I didn't believe anybody would help me ever. And so the idea that I would live off of other people helping me, that right there was an edge. But the thing that the teacher said was, when you get ready to give, Donna, put way more than you want to put in and begin to take some back. Take some back. And then see if where the line is where it says it doesn't feel like it's too much. Or the opposite of that would be don't give very much and then put a little more in. Put a little bit more in. Put a little bit more in. You have to actually learn where your own lines are, not follow some preset thought that says this is what I should be doing. That's what I think that this is what practice is about. There is no, it's like, I think what I'm trying to say is that the Buddha said that lay life is based in sensory and it's based in happiness from our satisfaction. So part of the reason why I think we have difficulty is because we have these preset thoughts about the way things should be. And those usually come from childhood and we're trying to live in that. Instead, practice comes from this framework that says it's all good. My stress is good. My not stress is good. It's all good because we're practicing with it. And then test the waters a little bit here and push up against it and see whether it works. See what happens. That's what I think you should do. Metta, opening the heart is always connected to metta and practices aligned with metta. Generosity, the paramis, all of that. But really where this edge I think is going to hit you is beginning to sit with the discomfort of not having enough. Is that even true? Right? That's what my sister's problem was. It wasn't true, but I couldn't tell her it wasn't true. And she just used that discomfort to believe that she didn't have enough. So I had to learn the same way with my gluttony. I had to learn that my discomfort in the middle of the month was coming because I spent everything up at the beginning of the month. I had to learn that. That wasn't something I just knew. I had to actually start practicing with the reality that I don't have any money because I spent it all. That's what I'm pointing to. So most all of this is practice. That's all it is practice and no judgment about how you feel about it. And it's not your job to make yourself, it's not your job to make your heart open so that you won't feel bad about the way you're spending money or not. That's not your job as a practitioner. Your job is just to practice with cultivating skillfulness when you see unskillfulness and abandon that. That's all it is. And the Dhamma actually figures out how to open your heart up. I hope that it's like, I'll say one thing. It's like us eating. It's not our job to digest food. We just eat it. And then the body does all the digesting. So it's, we can't open our heart. Our job is just to practice with practices that open the heart, and the body actually opens the heart. See that? Okay.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Jessica?
And I, too, am really excited that we're doing Dharma in daily life for this whole year. It's incredibly exciting. So thank you. I am really confused about probably something really basic here that you're talking about. When you're saying that happiness for lay people comes from sensory experiences, I'm confused by that, because I think, like for me, I think, okay, happiness comes from relationships, or like feeling really connected to others or even to myself. Like if I feel really connected, that makes me feel happy. Or if somebody helps me, that brings me joy. Or if I help somebody else, that brings me joy. Or this feeling of sort of love and connection, I think of, I associate that with happiness. And I think of sensory experiences as more sort of like fleeting experiences. So I'm confused.
Well, they are fleeting experiences, but our love for our, you know, partners and our relationships, these are sensory. We feel that with the sensory. That's what I was using that poem for. It's not just, we look for it, we look for good partners, we want to have a good partner and things like that, but it's really in how we feel with that person that we know that this is a good partner, this is a good match, we're connected. You can feel when your partner's in a good space with you and when they're not. These are all that I think what he was pointing to is that we don't live an austere life. We live a sensory life. There's going to be pleasure associated, both pleasant and unpleasant, associated with our lives as lay practitioners. That's what he's saying. But if you, let's say, you know, I'll just point out a thing to consider, right? So when you think about your relationship, this is just like with Katie. Instead of just thinking, oh, the relationship is where I have my happiness, think about what brings you happiness in that relationship. And how much that is connected to how much wealth you have or don't have. How is it in relation to the sense of wealth? In fact, somebody was saying that, like, it's not money when I say wealth. I'm not talking about money, how much money you have. I'm talking about just like me being at a Denny's restaurant talking with a group of friends. We didn't have money. But there was a sense of wealth there. There was a sense of abundance there. And at the same time, I know places when I felt very, very lonely, and a lot of my misery came from a sense of scarcity of people around me, and I felt like I was all by myself. So this is what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about wealth like only in relation to money, but money is part of that. Because we didn't have money and we could still sit there and be together, that almost made those Denny nights very, very special. Because we would pull our little dimes and nickels and dollars together just to buy a pot of coffee and see if we could stay for two rounds or one round. It all depended on how many quarters we had. So that's what I'm trying to say. It's not, you might think of it as we don't have any money, but all of that is intertwined together in lay life. That's what this is about, looking at all of it. And not just having a view that says, oh, happiness comes from relationships and that's where it's coming from. I think it might be coming from something else. But But it may come just from relationships, and maybe there's a sense of abundance around a relationship. That's what you're trying to look at. Just take the month to consider, what do you think of when you think about wealth? What does it mean? Or in relation to your sensory experience, is it the relationship or is it the felt sense experience you have with that person?
Thank you. That really helps.
Yeah. Alan, you're the last one.
Hey, Tuari.
Hey.
Similar, I think in a way, a similar question. I think this year is going to be a good challenge for me. Because, you know, for me, you know, when you talk about Bahaya Sutta, you know, or you talk about just meditation and those retreat experiences, like, that's my stuff. Like, I am so, in a way, addicted to that stuff. You know, when I got into that stuff, you know, stopped drinking, stopped doing video games, all the stuff that I like enjoyed in my life. I mean, I love my family, my kids, my spouse. I get that, you know, it's a similar kind of love and affection, but I'm like the Bahaya Sutta, when I can, you know, in the hearing only, the hearing and the seeing only, seeing, like, that's my stuff. So this year it's like, whoa, we're talking about some different stuff. No, that's, you know, that's my stuff.
That's the good stuff. That's where I'm going. That's what I want. Right? But
yes.
This is another reason why I'm glad that we're doing it and we're starting with wealth, because this is part of why that's your stuff. It's because you got to open up to that level of happiness in a lay life. Otherwise, you will always have the limitation that liberation is going to come when I get to the retreat. And if you got kids, you're kind of like struggling here on when I can get to that next retreat. And even if you do retreats at home, which if you have not tried one, you have got to try one because they are fantastic. But even if you do a retreat at home, you're trying to make everybody else live a certain way so that I can have my retreat experience I'm used to on the land. That's not what this is. The reason why we're practicing with this is because we are lay practitioners. We live a lay life. And it is giving us a year to begin to see that we could awaken in a lay life. That's what Buddha said to Bahia. You don't have to go to a retreat. You can practice at home. Deepama did, and she got past her teacher. So there's a way in which we can begin to step into these edges that we have, these beliefs that we don't even know exist until we talk about wealth. And all of a sudden, now I'm having some issues about this. Somebody said on Sunday they were having some major problems with this discussion. I don't know if I want to have this discussion. And that's because these are the things we live with. And we've always compartmentalized them and left our enlightenment, our opportunity to awaken for the next retreat I get to. And this is more about recognizing that we could do this here. We could do it. You can do it right here in your life. You don't have to go to a retreat in order for that to happen. But in your lay life, because it's sensory, you are going to come up against a lot of the limitations around your views. You're going to come up against unpleasantness. You're going to come up against dullness and wishing you had excitement and you don't have excitement and I don't have any money, so I can't do this. And I do have a lot of money, but I'm buying all this stuff up, but it's not really satisfying me. This is the kind of thing that we come up against in lay life. But this were our practices. It's what we're supposed to be practicing with. So this coming up against, that's where my stuff is, that's what we're supposed to be practicing with. Okay? That's good, though. Mm-hmm. We're all stirred up here, like, oh, I don't know. Some of you are like, I think I want to do this. I'm telling you good, but I don't know. maybe I don't want to do it. But it's good. Because, you know, Tim, he has all the hard parts. He got to talk about sex and all the rest of that stuff. I got the easy ones. So, anyway, I think it's going to be a good year. I'm excited.